Now, it's not just families with young kids who find it tough to travel these days. For Americans with hearing loss, being able to hear in airports and train stations can be a real challenge. Ashley Milne-Tite reports that a group of advocates is now trying to change that with help from a not-so-new technology.
When psychology professor David Myers went on vacation to Scotland, he was thrilled to visit 800-year-old Iona Abbey. But when the service began, he was lost.
As the sound reverberated around those ancient stone walls, it was indecipherable by the time it got to my ears.
Then his wife noticed a hearing assistance sign on the wall with a T on it. The T stood for telecoil. Myers was wearing hearing aids that contained a telecoil, a tiny, inexpensive part. He pressed a button on each hearing aid to activate the feature.
And what happened was just amazing. Suddenly, crystal clear sound was coming from the center of my head as if the person were 3 feet in front of my face.
The Abbey had installed a wire called a hearing loop or induction loop. It transmits sound via a magnetic signal to the telecoil in a hearing aid or cochlear implant. Once switched on, that telecoil acts as a personal wireless loudspeaker for the listener. 69% of new hearing aid models contain telecoils. Here's how a regular church service can sound to a hearing aid wearer.
The second lesson, be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord.
Now here's that sound again, transmitted via hearing loop.
The second lesson, be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord.
Hearing loops are common in public spaces and at ticket windows in Britain and Scandinavia. Since he got back from Scotland, Myers has been on a mission to bring them to the US. His part of Michigan now has hundreds, from senior centres to the Grand Rapids Airport. But hearing assistance systems in this country more commonly use infrared or FM signals to transmit sound. Myers says the problem with that technology is it requires people with hearing loss to do the work.
To get up, locate, check out, wear and return special equipment.
Either a headset or a neck loop, which many people with imperfect hearing are reluctant to do. Janice Schachter runs an advocacy group in New York City called the Hearing Access Program.
People with hearing loss actually want dignity. They don't want a big neon sign that says, I have a hearing loss.
Schachter's daughter, Arielle, now 17, has severe hearing loss. Family outings became a trial.
We would go to a Broadway show and she couldn't hear the sound. Sometimes the sound director would think the music was loud enough and they therefore didn't need to mic the music into the headset. Sometimes the headsets were broken.
Schachter's organization has helped get hearing loops installed at New York venues like the Natural History Museum, a branch of the Apple Store, and most of the information booths in the notoriously noisy subway system. Arielle Schachter says the hearing loop in the booth at this station funnels the transit worker's voice right into her ear and blocks out the subway noise behind her. Without it,
I would have a much more difficult time. I would be relying less on hearing and more on lip reading in doing that. And I mean, that's not perfect.
Her mother is continuing her push to loop New York City and other places too. Janice Schachter says as baby boomers age, they'll want as hassle-free a way to hear as possible. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite in New York.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Do the police need a warrant to read your email? Believe it or not, 2 decades into the internet age, the answer to that question is still maybe. It depends on how old the email is, where you keep it. It even depends on whom you ask. NPR's Martin Kosty reports that some big-name tech companies are asking Congress to step in and clarify online privacy rights.
If you do run afoul of the law, and you happen to be one of the millions who use Gmail, then the cops will likely be directing their inquiries to this building. The legal department at Google in Mountain View, California. This building has the same college dorm feel as the rest of the Google campus. There's the pool table, free food, young people in t-shirts. But that doesn't mean they're not busy. Every month, Google gets about 1,000 government requests for user data.
We get agents calling us on the phone. We get faxes and emails and snail mail. Sometimes we'll have an investigator show up in the lobby with a piece of paper.
Richard Salgado is senior counsel at Google. He says most law enforcement requests are legitimate and Google complies promptly. But there are times when Google says, not so fast.
My view and Google's view is that for the government to compel a provider to disclose the content of private communications, they need to get a search warrant.
A warrant means police have to show probable cause. It's a higher level of oversight, the kind of court order that cops need before they come into your home and, say, rummage through your desk. The thing is, search warrants take more time and effort, so police sometimes point to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986. It says they don't need a warrant for older emails. Salgado admits that's true, and it's a problem.
I think that your average user would be very surprised to hear the federal privacy statute that governs cloud computing would allow the disclosure of their emails with nothing more than an administrative subpoena.
So Google insists on a warrant anyway, a warrant signed by a judge on the theory that emails enjoy a higher constitutional protection. Two federal appeals courts in different parts of the country have echoed this argument, and most law enforcement agencies now do tend to get warrants. But tech companies say that still doesn't resolve the bigger problem, that federal internet privacy law, which is 25 years old, and they say, out of date. To dramatize the point, the Center for Democracy and Technology, a privacy think tank, recently held a retro tech fair at the U.S. Capitol featuring computers that are of the same vintage as the privacy law.
We've got a Compaq Portable 3 from 1987 running that bright orange-colored screen with WordPerfect 5.1.
Jim Dempsey is the CDT's vice president for public policy. He also helped to organize Digital Due Process, an alliance of privacy groups and big tech companies that's now trying to update the law. He says industry has a financial interest here.
They realize that their business depends upon the trust of their consumers. And when they're selling their technology and selling their cloud computing services, they're constantly facing, from Europeans and from others, oh, Patriot Act, U.S. surveillance, our data is not secure if we trust it to an American company.
The law can also be just plain confusing. For instance, it provides greater privacy protection for communications than it does for stored documents. But what about, say, a document you're sharing with someone else online? Is that a form of communication or storage? Dempsey wants to see a baseline of privacy protection for all online content, regardless of technology. That kind of a sweeping new privacy standard raises some red flags for law enforcement, as Associate Deputy Attorney General James A. Baker told the Senate Judiciary Committee.
If we were to raise the standard with respect to some electronic communications, even content, it's going to have an impact on law enforcement investigations. We have to be mindful of that. We have to be thoughtful about that. And so whatever proposals come forward, we have to look at that in that light.
There is a bill now in the Senate. It's ambitious, covering everything from cloud computing to location data on phones. The chief sponsor, Democrat Patrick Leahy, hopes to move it through the Judiciary Committee before the next election. But even if it passes the Senate, the bill faces a tougher challenge in the House, where the tech industry's lobbying muscle is less likely to overcome the Republican majority's reluctance to hamper law enforcement. Martin Costi, NPR News.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin, in for Guy Raz. New tensions today between the U.S. and Pakistan. Islamabad is accusing NATO of killing more than 20 Pakistani soldiers in an incident on the Afghan border. Pakistan has shut down one of the main supply routes for U.S. troops into Afghanistan. Pakistan is also pressuring the U.S. to leave an airbase sometimes used by the CIA for drone strikes, a demand they have made before. U.S. drones have been the key tool in the counterterrorism fight in Pakistan, also the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But the technology has raised all kinds of questions about the nature of aerial combat. That's our cover story today, the evolution of remote-controlled war. To understand where drone technology came from, it's helpful to travel back in time.
I'm standing in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum with Peter Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We're standing beneath a very old airplane.
Essentially a plane that's made out of canvas, wood, very fragile compared to materials today.
It's a replica of the Wright military flyer built in 1909, when a lot of people didn't think such a thing was even possible.
So we first have the concept that's really, what we would now call science fiction. In fact, in 1903, the New York Times says that it will take millions of engineers and mechanicians tens of thousands of years to build an actual flying machine. The very same day, two brothers in Dayton, Ohio, start to assemble the first real flying machine in their bicycle shop.
Here, the Wrights, without even a high school education, were first gripped with the dream of building a machine that would fly.
Then people look around and they go, hold it, this might be useful in that other thing that humans like to do, which is fight.
The War Department opened bids for a heavier-than-air flying machine. The Wright signed a stiff contract.
And all of this starts in someone's imagination. People think they're crazy, and all of a sudden it's adapted for all kinds of uses.
It's just like any other technology, whether it's what happened with a horseless carriage or what happened with a computer. Starts out as imagination, and then it gets crossed with innovation, profit-seeking, and most importantly, that horrible human need to figure out how to destroy one another.
This is Titan 1-4. No signs of life.
Today, like the Wright brothers, the Air Force is still trying to convince people that what they do isn't science fiction.
Titan 1-4, hold your position.
That's literally the tagline for this Air Force recruiting ad.
Unmanned aircraft is identifying enemy sniper.
It shows a robotic aircraft scanning a desert landscape with a camera that looks like a bright red eye, alerting troops on the ground of a nearby sniper.
Thanks, Reaper 1-1. We got it from here.
The message on the screen, it's not science fiction. It's what we do every day. Back at the Air and Space Museum, there's an exhibit featuring planes a lot like the one in the Air Force ad. You've heard them called drones, though the Air Force doesn't like that term much. They call them remotely piloted aircraft. Peter Singer has written about remote technology in his book, Wired for War.
So right here at the other end of the museum, and I think somewhat ironically, wedged in the corner because even the Air and Space Museum sort of doesn't know what to do almost with this next generation, you've got a Predator, you've got an X-45 down here. They're actually just like that Wright Brothers flyer. They're the first generation of all this. They may look exotic, they may sound exotic, but they're already outdated compared to what is now operating and what comes next.
What does come next? Singer says not a single Western aerospace company has a manned combat aircraft in research and development. The Air Force says it now recruits more pilots for unmanned planes than fighter and bomber pilots combined. The MQ-1 Predator is the military's main workhorse. In September 2001, the Air Force had one. Today, they have 57 Predators flying 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We wanted to know what these changes mean for the men and women in uniform.
I'm Major General James Poss. I'm the Deputy Chief of Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance for the United States Air Force.
Poss helps oversee the Air Force's surveillance programs, which mostly revolve around drones. It's a program that's grown dramatically in just the last few years. Take this story from a couple years ago. Poss was speaking to a group of new Air Force officers in Alabama, trying to get the crowd fired up.
You know, I asked how many folks were going to fly transport aircraft, big cheer. How many folks wanted to fly fighter aircraft, huge cheer. Then I asked them, well, who wants to fly the single most effective weapon system in the global war on terror in the United States Air Force? Who wants to fly the MQ-1 Predator? Not only was there silence, there was a couple boos, but this was about...
Poss knew how they felt. He joined the Air Force in May of 1992 for the same reason. He wanted to be a fighter pilot, but it wasn't long before he found out he needed glasses.
So had to go with Plan B, which was to be an intelligence officer, which I have to admit has been almost as much fun as being a fighter pilot.
But an Air Force recruit today might not need a Plan B. Remote aircraft pilots don't need perfect vision. They don't have to worry about getting airsick. The job has become more popular with recruits. In fact, the Air Force now has a career path specifically for drone pilots. They're still looking for the same qualities: spatial awareness, quick critical thinking skills. Still, flying drones is different.
unlike a person that deploys to combat, our remotely piloted aircraft force never leave combat. And that's got unique psychological stresses. You really don't get a break. And even more jarring is you do leave your ground control station and drive home, and you have to mow the lawn.
Because at least when you're deployed or in a combat zone, everyone is aware that you've endured this.
Absolutely.
And this group of pilots doesn't have that built-in support.
No, they've still got the built-in support of their fellow airmen that are conducting the mission. The difference is you never leave the combat zone. We've got a Predator pilot that hasn't left the skies of Southwest Asia for 9 years. We've got an international...
What does that mean? Someone's been sitting somewhere...
Someone has been... this captain has been sitting at Creech Air Force Base flying over Southwest Asia 8 to 10 hours a day, 5 to 6 days a week, 52 weeks a year for the past 9 years. It's a lot of unique stressors that you put on this type of force, but the overwhelming advantage we get to the Air Force is that if you want to go and talk to a world expert on Iraq or Afghanistan, maybe you don't need to go to Iraq or Afghanistan. Maybe you need to talk to that young captain down at Creech, because they've been staring at that ground for the past 9 years.
So that seat, the one you could potentially sit in for 9 years, what does that feel like?
If you'd like, you can hop in the seat, fly the airplane around, get a feel for it.
I paid a visit to Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico, a big training center for drone pilots. One of the instructors let me try flying a simulator for the MQ-1 Predator.
There's nothing to it.
All right.
And I promise you won't break anything.
Let's see. Okay, so I'm actually sitting in the pilot operator chair now.
So we call this the heads-up display.
Okay.
But projected onto it is all your flight information, including an artificial horizon, your airspeed, your altitude, etc.
The computer terminal is made to look like the control panels in a real cockpit, and the operator can decide how much the plane should do on its own. For instance, you can program the aircraft to fly itself around a given range.
But as you can see, you don't have a lot of control over what the airplane's doing, so if you're trying to maximize the quality of the image that you're producing, now you may have to do a little more work as the pilot. So I'm going to take off that pre-programmed mode.
Okay.
So if you push forward on the stick, the nose is going to dip.
Oh, hello. Is it possible to crash these?
Oh, sure.
It is.
It's not difficult.
There's not some fail-safe program in here that keeps them from crashing.
You know, this airplane, because it's a tactical airplane, is designed to give the pilot as much control as possible when you're flying it via a satellite link. It is possible to over-control the aircraft or to lose your situational awareness and put the airplane into an unrecoverable situation.
An unrecoverable situation, as in the plane goes down, but the pilot isn't injured because he's in front of a computer in New Mexico. There is physical and psychological distance between the pilot and the plane. And Peter Singer says that distance is changing the way we think about war.
The U.S. has carried out 307 airstrikes into Pakistan. In the Libya case, the president said, we're just going to provide support to the Europeans, so I don't need authorization from Congress. Because as they put in the letter to Congress, U.S. forces won't have any risk of casualties. But we carried out 146 airstrikes, including the one that helped get Gaddafi in the end. And the point here is that engaging in combat and people being at risk have always been together until now. The technology allows you to disentangle them, and now a new age of war has started.
And the big question is, how much more automated will war become? Singer says there are dozens of other countries that are at different stages of developing their own drone technology. Will there be a time when air-to-air combat is fully automated? General Paas says maybe.
But I always see a human making that final call on whether or not that is a legitimate target. And I certainly always see a human making the call on whether or not to release a weapon on that target.
Back at the museum, Pete Singer says once a revolutionary technology has been unleashed, it's hard not to push its potential.
And so what we're seeing is that these robotic planes, but also we have them on the ground and at sea, they are revolutionary technologies. Revolutionary technologies are technologies that are really rare in history. They're things like the steam engine, gunpowder, the computer, the atomic bomb. The key is that they're not technologies that solve all your problems. Rather, they're technologies that open up an incredible amount of new both possibilities and dilemmas and perils to figure out.
Dilemmas like how to use drone strikes in an enemy state with its own drones or in a country that's supposed to be an ally, like Pakistan. Earlier today, NASA's latest Mars mission left Earth, heading on its journey to the Red Planet.
3, 2, 1, main engine start, 0, and liftoff of the Atlas V with Curiosity, seeking clues to the planetary puzzle about life on Mars.
The Mars Science Laboratory will land next August. The spacecraft won't be making any scientific observations during its interplanetary cruise, but there's still plenty to do on the 8.5-month trip to Mars. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Operating Mars Science Laboratory in cruise mode isn't nearly as exciting as it will be to operate when it's roving around on the surface of Mars. Charles Baker of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena is cruise mission planner for the Mars Science Laboratory. I asked him what mission scientists and engineers do during the long interplanetary cruise.
Is this a time where people, you know, get their tans all set and you know, relax with a cool drink by the pool while they wait for the thing to get to Mars?
That would be ideal, but not even close.
Baker says there are a number of critical operations that have to occur before the mission can reach its ultimate destination. These start shortly after launch.
The first thing we want to check out is the ability to navigate and the ability to see stars.
Although the spacecraft will be tracked from Earth, it's important that it knows where it is as well.
And then we get into our first trajectory correction maneuvers.
This is to refine the path to Mars. The rocket that launches the spacecraft from Earth gets it going in basically the right direction, but there are always tweaks needed. In fact, until the final tweaks, the trajectory is calculated so the spacecraft will miss Mars. That's so if mission managers should lose control of the spacecraft, it won't splat on the surface. NASA doesn't want to contaminate the Martian environment. The rover that will actually land on Mars is nestled in a special cocoon during the cruise.
We have to check out the instruments that are on board. Remember, the rover has a suite of instruments.
The goal is to be sure everything is working, at least electronically. Baker says there are more than 100 separate tasks that the spacecraft will perform during the cruise. Only next August, when the rover is safely on the surface of Mars, will Baker be able to head to the pool.
My role essentially is over when we're on the surface.
Once on the surface, the Mars Science Laboratory is supposed to explore an area on Mars called Gale Crater. Observation from Mars orbit shows clays and minerals in the crater that suggest they were formed by interactions with water. But this mission is supposed to do more than just look for signs of water. Caltech's John Grotzinger is principal investigator for the Mars Science Laboratory.
We're going to land a rover that can move around and explore for habitable environments where microorganisms may have existed in the past or may possibly exist today.
Finding conditions that could sustain life isn't the same as actually finding evidence of life. But understanding the conditions on Mars will help scientists know what kind of life to look for. Joe Palca, NPR News.
It's a tough time to get anything through on Capitol Hill with bipartisan support these days. So when a financial bill passed the hyper-polarized House of Representatives with flying colors earlier this month, we took note and wanted to dig a little further. The bill is designed to make it easier for aspiring small business owners to get money from investors through the internet. It's called crowdfunding. The legislation allows businesses to sell unregistered securities, but there are still some rules. Each business person can't raise more than $2 million, and each investment can't be higher than $10,000. NPR's Aarti Shahani has more on how Democrats and Republicans came together to give startups a boost.
While everyone may not agree on financial deregulation, when it's for the little guy, it draws a supportive crowd, a crowd of lawmakers and crowdfunders, to be exact.
On this vote, the yeas are 407, the nays are 17. The bill is passed.
Earlier this month, the House passed the Entrepreneur Access to Capital Act.
So you were surprised?
I was quite surprised. One of my Republicans said this bill should be renamed the Obama-McHenry Friendship Bill.
That's Congressman Patrick McHenry, the North Carolina conservative who introduced the bill. At a small victory rally, he says the measure is simply
eliminating a regulation so you can let capitalism be free in this country. There's a wider belief in the power of crowdfunding and what it can do to help job creation.
Crowdfunding is a way for entrepreneurs to raise money on the internet from people they may not personally know. Currently, all sorts of do-gooder causes get donations through engines like Kickstarter.com. But because of a securities law born of the Great Depression to prevent fraud, for-profit businesses can't ask strangers to invest. The crowdfunding bill would change that. Virginia resident Osiris Hoyle stood at the victory rally alongside McHenry. Today, Hoyle is a restaurateur. Just 2 years ago, he was a laid-off construction worker, mulling around at home, cooking for fun and solace.
When I moved to the United States, I started getting better with my culinary as a Mexican because I miss my mom's food.
A neighbor loved Hoyle's authentic family recipes enough to invest $25,000 in a food truck for him, among D.C.'s first. 1 year later, District Taco has 33 employees, two trucks, and a restaurant in Arlington, Virginia.
Number 12, El Osito. Number 12.
The business is a local staple with a cyber strategy. Hoyle tweets daily specials to over 6,000 followers, another 1,300 eye him on Facebook. Under current law, Hoyle can't ask these followers to become shareholders, and he thinks that's unfair, not just to him.
We don't own District Taco. The customer owns District Taco because they built it. You know, I would like for them to get something back.
Dana Moriello works for people just like Hoyle. She's the entrepreneur's entrepreneur. In 2009, she launched ProFounder, a consulting company that helps businesses crowdfund. Moriello testified before the House Financial Services Committee in support of the bill. She says it could solve market inefficiency without introducing rampant new fraud.
You could have great entrepreneurs, communities that want to support them, and yet for some reason those two parties just can't connect. We don't see a particularly viable scenario where total strangers are going to wander onto this marketplace and invest in deals from people they don't know in areas they don't care about.
Jack Herstein is skeptical. He's president of the North American Securities Administrators Association and investigates fraud for the state of Nebraska. In the typical scam, con artist...
You just need a few investors to jump in, spread the word around how great it is, and the next thing you know, the website's down and the money's gone.
The bill could make a bad situation worse by taking regulation out of the picture. It would create an exemption for small businesses so that they don't have to register investment activity with the state that they're located in.
Once you preempt state law, it is gone. It's very difficult to get that back.
Investing is a risk that District Taco regular Lisa Merman is willing to take if given the chance.
If I could do it in a small way, in a community business that I use and trust, I would love to do that because it would be a chance to be a part of it. And at a low dollar amount, it's a low risk.
Would you feel as a part of it if you just bought 500 tacos?
I can't eat 500 tacos, so no.
Right beside her is Brian Waldman.
This morning I had a colonoscopy, and the first thing I wanted to have as soon as I left was District Tacos.
If his pockets run half as deep as that appetite and the crowdfunding bill becomes law, this company is in business. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin, in for Guy Raz. We begin today with a story about information espionage and one traveler's ritual to protect himself. Ken Lieberthal of the Brookings Institution works in China a lot.
Most years I go about 10 times a year, yeah.
He does some business consulting, meets with other scholars at universities, sometimes with government officials. And like a lot of us these days, he carries electronics with him to do his work. But for Lieberthal, it's a lot more complicated than just throwing a laptop into a briefcase and hitting the road. He takes precautions.
I first of all get a loaner laptop, and the USB that I bring, I have cleaned digitally before I bring it, so that it's totally blank.
Lots of precautions.
Disconnect the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth functions, set the email filters, and that tunnels under the Chinese firewall. So that's all before the trip.
Once he's actually in China, he's just as careful. His BlackBerry never leaves his side.
I never leave it in my hotel room.
He never uses a Wi-Fi connection when he's got a USB drive plugged in.
I'm always careful to log out completely when I'm not using it.
He also physically hides his fingers when typing passwords. And when he gets home, everything gets wiped clean. Paranoia, you say? Maybe. But the U.S. government is now blaming China publicly for hacking American industries. That's our cover story today, Chinese cyber espionage and the impact on the U.S. economy. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee is Republican Congressman Mike Rogers of Michigan. This week, Rogers plans to bring forward a bill designed to put more pressure on China for alleged cyber attacks.
They are ferocious economic predators, and it is something we are going to have to deal with and deal with it soon.
This public naming and shaming is a new tactic. Up until recently, U.S. officials have been pressuring China behind closed doors. But a counterintelligence report released last month directly accused China of hacking into the computer systems of American businesses. And it's not just business travelers at risk. Any piece of digital data can be acquired through moles within a company or hackers operating half a world away. More from Mike Rogers later on, but first, James Lewis directs the technology program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The Chinese decided when they opened their economy to the West that one of the things they needed to do was upgrade their technology, that they were falling behind. There's a famous letter from three Chinese scientists to Deng Xiaoping in March of 1986. It says, "We're falling behind the Americans. We're never going to catch up unless we make a huge investment in science and technology." And so the Chinese have, you know, it's like the tortoise and the hare. The Chinese have, since 1986, been plugging steadily along at building up their technological capacities, and that includes cyber espionage. And to be fair, we ought to note, China is not the only country that does this. Mm-hmm. A lot of countries engage in this kind of economic collection, in this kind of electronic eavesdropping.
But the U.S. has had a particular focus on China. Why is that? Why does the United States perceive this threat as most dangerous because it's coming from China?
Whether it's true or not, we increasingly see China as our most likely competitor in the world. And the Chinese, I think, feel that way too. So like it or not, the two of us are kind of spiraling into a competitive relationship that could involve military tensions that reach the point of conflict. You've got another problem, which is the Chinese believe, you know, with a little merit, they had what they call the century of humiliation. Westerners, mainly British and French, were mean to them, and you had the experience of imperialism. They feel like the West owes them, and so one of the things they do is say, how do we catch up? How do we get Western technology? How about if we borrow it from unsuspecting donors? And they are one of the leading countries when it comes to economic espionage. So we see them in a special light.
When you think about the threat to the United States and businesses, what specific industries are most vulnerable?
The ones that have been the most vulnerable are the high-tech industries and the defense industries, because China has identified those as places where they want to grow. When you talk to people in the intelligence community, though, they'll tell you that they see really unusual incidents. One group was telling me about a case involving Chinese hackers breaking into a furniture company in the United States and stealing the plans for furniture. You can see the immediate economic benefit. You don't have to pay for the design. You can build it cheaper, and you can offer the same product at a lower price, maybe even get it to market a little faster. That hurts the economy, and that's one of the things that we need to think about, is this is damaging our economy.
James Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Now, Congressman Mike Rogers, by the way, he's a former FBI agent, he has actually spoken with executives from some of the American businesses hit by cyber attacks.
There is one particular company who is in the high-end manufacturing sector. They spent billions in research and development trying to get this particular product to where it was. Now China produces that particular product. They stole the intellectual property, and their estimation is it cost them hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue and 10,000 jobs at a minimum. So those are 10,000 jobs that would be in this economy, that would employ Americans, that are gone because of Chinese economic espionage. Business after business after business has lost valuable, and by the way, the new estimate is maybe up to $1 trillion with a T dollars a year worth of intellectual property, $1 trillion. I will tell you this, Rachel, there are two companies left in the United States that possess intellectual property in their products. Those that know they've been hacked and those that don't know they've been hacked.
And the companies that don't know they're hacked, basically what you're saying is we don't understand the breadth of this problem.
You know, it's not like someone is kicking your puppy. You can see that. You can get pretty angry about it, and you're going to do something about it. When somebody is in your network and slowly and quietly stealing your most valued asset of your company, your intellectual property, it is hard to see it and get fired up about it and get emotional about it. It happens every single day. And the Chinese aren't the only ones. They happen to be the most pervasive. The Russians are engaged. The Iranians are now engaged. Other nation states are starting to develop and invest in this kind of technology and expertise. And we've got to start getting the awareness up of the American people and our American business community what the threat really is.
U.S. defense officials who work on cybersecurity and with a focus on Asia have said it's actually very difficult in the end to trace it to specific governments, these kinds of cyber attacks, because oftentimes it's routed through other servers in different countries. Are you confident that you have some kind of evidence that connects these episodes to China?
I will say with a very high degree of confidence, as somebody who was in the business of collecting evidence. This is not evidence, but I was in the business of collecting evidence that the Chinese government is actively involved in economic espionage.
What are the most egregious examples?
Well, there is, and here was the other set of problems. When I went to have an open hearing on this particular issue, the companies that we know were hacked were very reluctant to come forward. Two reasons, both concerning. One was they realized that this would affect either their brand name or the fact that it might affect people wanting to invest in these particular companies. And the second part of that was some of them outright said, if I publicly talk about the fact that the Chinese have hacked my particular system, I can tell you that my system will be overrun within a very short period by continued hackers.
Up until this most recent counterintelligence report was released, U.S. officials have really preferred to exert pressure on China privately about all of this. Why call China out publicly? Why the change?
Well, if you understand the culture of China, they hate public humiliation. It is something that can drive their decision-making. And for too long, the decision has been made, if we just don't talk about it, maybe we can do something about it. I've made the determination as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee that we have got to start recognizing this problem publicly. And we need to raise this to the highest levels of our bilateral relationships with Russia and China and other nations. And so no longer is this not something we should talk about. It is absolutely something we should talk about.
But besides this public rhetoric and very strong language, what else can the U.S. do?
We're going to increase our penalties. We're going to increase our defense capabilities against it here.
When you say penalties, what would that mean as far as punitive measures?
Well, it could mean anything. It could mean that if they have foreign companies that they have established as front companies, that those companies would have civil and criminal penalties applied, as well as other trade issues that we're going to have to look at as we move forward. Again, it's very important that this become a bilateral trade issue so that we can finally get a handle on it.
Congressman Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. We asked the spokesperson at the Chinese embassy in Washington, Wang Baodong, to respond to the U.S. allegations. He sent us a statement that says cyber attacks are not just a Chinese issue, but a global issue, and hackers are striking from everywhere. He also says the charges against China are, quote, harmful not only to the interests of American travelers, but also to increased exchanges between our two countries. And such a willful demonization effort against China should be stopped. Even though U.S. officials are convinced there's a cyber threat coming from China, they still don't know the extent of the attacks or exactly who is waging them, which makes it hard to figure out how to make them stop.